Welcome to the June 2013 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pynchon. The June issue is on the topic of epilepsy. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Oren Sager of the University of Michigan speaks with Dr. Sumit Vadera and Dr. Dawn Taylor to discuss their article, Stereoelectroencephalography for Continuous Two-Dimensional Cursor Control in a Brain-Machine Interface.
It's my pleasure to serve as your host for this Neurosurgical Focus podcast. My name is Dr. Oren Sager, and I am professor of neurosurgery at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Along with Dr. Charles Liu from the University of Southern California and Dr. Howard Eisenberg of the University of Maryland, I recently had the pleasure of serving as topic editor for this month's issue of Neurosurgical Focus, which is entitled Epilepsy. This issue of Neurosurgical Focus covers a wide spectrum of topics involving epilepsy surgery and research and delves into cutting-edge developments in epilepsy and brain mapping. We were very pleased to get a number of high-quality manuscripts included in the June issue and selected the paper Stereoencephalography for Continuous Two-Dimensional Cursor Control in a Brain-Machine Interface by Sumit Vadera, Amr Morathe, Jorge Gonzalez-Martinez, and Dawn Taylor for our monthly podcast. This study addresses a topic that has enjoyed a recent resurgence of interest in the field of epilepsy, stereoencephalography, or SEEG, and discusses the potential of applying this technique to the burgeoning field of brain-machine interface development. We are fortunate to have us today two of the authors of this paper. The lead author, Dr. Sumit Vadera, a PGY6 neurosurgical resident at the Cleveland Clinic, and Dr. Dawn Taylor, assistant professor of neurosciences at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner Research Science Institute, and a research scientist at the Cleveland VA. She is the corresponding author of this interesting paper. This group is an extremely active one in the field of epilepsy surgery and brain-machine interfaces. Moreover, the Cleveland Clinic is one of very few centers that utilize the technique of SEEG and have led the resurgence of this interesting technique. I'm sure these two authors will give us some very useful insights into what I consider a very exciting new field in neuromodulation. First of all, I would like to welcome both of you, Dr. Vadera and Dr. Taylor, to our program today. It's a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So perhaps, Dr. Vadera, if you could start, and maybe Dr. Taylor as well, start by describing your personal interest and background into this field.
My name is Sumit Vadera. I'm a PGY6 neurosurgery resident at the Cleveland Clinic. Last year I did an infolded fellowship in epilepsy surgery under both Dr. William Bingaman as well as Dr. Jorge Gonzalez-Martinez at the clinic. During this year, I did have the opportunity to perform multiple invasive evaluations for seizure localization. This includes both subdural grids as well as stereoelectroencephalography, or SEEG. I became very interested in these surgeries during this time. One of my research interests is with brain-machine interface technology, and so this year I'm doing a research fellowship in Dawn Taylor's lab. These last 2 years have been really great, and I feel fortunate that my clinical interests in epilepsy surgery go well with my research interests in brain-machine interface.
So, Dr. Taylor, maybe you can describe a little bit of your personal background into this field.
Okay. I've been doing brain-machine interfacing research for over a decade now, and my research area has spanned both non-invasive EEG stuff as well as invasive subdural grids, the SEEGs reported in this paper, as well as intercortical microelectrodes. And my work has also spanned animal and human research areas, but particularly focusing on brain-machine interface with the goal of helping paralyzed people regain use of their limbs just by thinking about moving.
That's excellent. So perhaps we can start with you, Dr. Vadera. Your study utilized epilepsy patients undergoing a procedure known as stereoencephalography, or SEEG, prior to having surgery for their epilepsy. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about SEEG, maybe a little bit about the history of SEEG, and how it's being used in epilepsy.
All right, great. So SEEG was first developed and popularized in France in the 1950s, and it's still a very commonly used procedure in Europe for epilepsy mapping. Essentially, it involves stereotactic placement of depth electrodes for the localization of the ictal onset zone. To begin with, patients are discussed in a multidisciplinary epilepsy conference where a hypothesis is created about the location of the ictal onset zone. That's based upon the anatomy of the patient as well as both electrical and functional networks which are maybe involved. This is the most important step for a successful SEEG procedure. After the discussion, based upon what the preoperative hypothesis is, as well as what the patient's clinical presentation is, either subdural grids or SEEG is decided upon at the Cleveland Clinic. If SEEG is chosen, an implantation strategy is developed, which is tailored specifically to that patient. What we'll do is we always want to evaluate the lesion if there's one present, as well as what the presumed ictal onset zone is, and any associated limbic networks.
So how many electrodes does a patient typically have implanted in one of these sessions?
Just looking at Dr. Gonzalez-Martinez's experiences, I would say on average of about 13 per person.
How does one plan to place these electrodes? How do you decide where to put them?
So like I had mentioned, the most important thing is the discussion that occurs during the Epilepsy Management Conference. And based upon that, really the things that we look for, we want to explore if there's a lesion, if there's one present, whether there's an ictal onset zone or what we consider to be what the possible ictal onset zone is, and then also we'll implant any functional network areas associated with, like, perhaps with the limbic system.
Is this planning any different from the planning you use for put in a subdural grid or strip electrodes?
So the subdural grid procedures, we generally perform a large craniotomy. We'll place the electrodes across the cortex in all the areas that we are concerned about. The SEEG procedure is a little different because we're using these depth electrodes, so we don't have the benefit of going across large cortical areas. So instead, we're more concerned with the deeper structures. And that's actually one of the main benefits of SEEG, which is that it samples deep cortical and subcortical structures. You can get multiple non-contiguous lobes. You can perform bilateral explorations, which is a lot tougher with subdural grids. And, you don't require a large craniotomy for that.
So you described some of the advantages of SEEG. What are the disadvantages of doing this compared to, example, subdural grids?
One of the disadvantages is that it's not as good at cortical mapping as subdural grids would be. You know, when we implant, especially on the left side, when you're concerned about speech or, anything in the perirolandic region, with the subdural grids, you have a much better ability to do functional mapping related to that. Because the SEEG electrode is so thin and really only enters at that one cortical spot, it's not as easy or as good at doing functional mapping. Another disadvantage would be that you don't see what's happening as you're passing the electrode, so if there's any kind of bleeding which may occur, it's not as easy to treat as if something were to happen during an open craniotomy.
I see. So what do you do to try to mitigate that kind of risk? Because I think most of the listeners to this podcast would cringe at the thought of putting in a dozen electrodes into the brain, kind of like a fork. How do you reduce that risk?
I can go over kind of what the workflow is that Dr. Gonzalez-Martinez does, and that may answer that question. So what usually gets done is that a patient will have a T1 volumetric MR performed the day before surgery. On the day of surgery, they are brought to the OR, they're placed under general anesthesia, and then we put the Lexel head frame on. At that point, they get an angiogram as well as a DynaCT, and then what we do is we take all that information and fuse it with the pre-op MR. Then the targets that we had predefined, we put them on this fused image, and then we also create trajectories based on what would be the safest. So we have both the MRI, but more importantly, we have this angiogram, which allows us to see what the vascular territories are. And so it allows us to carefully place these electrodes so that we're not traversing any major vessels or any vessels, really.
Is it really a technological tour de force to do this? In this paper that you're presenting in this issue, your team reports on a fairly unusual use of SEEG. And in your paper, in your study, you used them as a brain-machine interface system. So maybe we can transition and talk a little bit about that. Dr. Taylor, maybe you can tell our audience what a brain-machine interface is.
Certainly. In very general terms, a brain-machine interface is any type of system that extracts information from brain signals in real time and then uses that information to control a device. So, for example, motor system brain-machine interfaces, or BMIs, have been designed to enable severely paralyzed individuals to use their thoughts of movement to control the movement of various devices, such as a computer mouse or a robotic arm, just by thinking about movement. Their movement intent would be decoded from the brain signals in real time and then used to drive the device motion. Other brain-machine interfaces can use involuntary signals. There's been a lot of development of communication BMIs for locked-in individuals, and these can often use involuntary responses, such as the system where letters are flashed on the screen in random patterns, and the person who is focusing on the screen, and when they see the letter they want to type, their brain has an involuntary response, which is a P300, or a slight positive change in the voltage about 300 milliseconds after they recognize something that they're trying to look for. In that way, that system can detect when the person is seeing a letter that they are trying to type and then type that letter for them. So you can use motor signals, you can use involuntary brain responses, or just about anything. And a broader definition of BMI of just general using signals in real time to control something, this would include things like closed-loop control of deep brain stimulation systems, where the person's brain state is being monitored in real time and then used to modify the stimulation parameters in their system. Or more relevant to this particular journal issue would be detection of potentially an oncoming epileptic seizure to then trigger some intervention, or at least give an alarm to alert the person that a seizure is coming.
Yes, there seems to be a lot of different ways to use the brain signal. I'm just kind of wondering, what specific applications are you working, you know, right now to develop? The cursor control I see is one. Is the letter recognition and communication that way, is that the next one? Or what do you see as the low-lying fruit there?
Well, my lab's actually trying to get the high-lying fruit, unfortunately. And the cursor control is kind of a proxy that we're using for what we really would like to develop, which would be restoring function to paralyzed individuals where the brain signals are being used in real time to trigger implanted stimulators that can reanimate the paralyzed limbs. So basically using this technology to bypass damage in the spinal cord to where their intended movement is decoded from the brain and then put back into their paralyzed limb through these implanted peripheral nerve stimulators. There's many different applications, but that's specifically what we're focusing on here in my lab in conjunction with the Cleveland Functional Electrical Stimulation Center, who's developing the implanted stimulation systems. But as far as the communication systems have been being developed with EEGs as well as more invasive technologies, and those have been around for a long time, and improvements keep being made on those. As far as other applications, there's quite a variety of applications. There's, you know, video game controllers now being developed where people just stick these little caps on that don't require gel or any kind of conductive paste. For the most part, those are actually most likely using scalp muscle activity than actual true brain activity. But companies are jumping on the bandwagon for getting into finding a lot of, you know, more broadly commercial non-medical applications such as video game controllers. And even potentially, you know, putting a sensor in a cap of truck drivers to detect when they're about to fall asleep, to send an alarm, something like that. So there's a lot of various applications, but for the most part, the brain-machine interface application has started with the development of helping severely disabled individuals interact with their environment through a communication system or through the ability to control their computer or robotic device, etc. But the applications more broadly medically are closed-loop control of various devices such as deep brain stimulation or some kind of epilepsy therapeutic intervention as well.
Right. But, you know, as far as this particular study is concerned, you're looking at something in order to have the subject be able to manipulate their environment using their brain rather than a closed-loop feedback system for epilepsy patients. The question comes up, if you're trying to help spinal cord injury patients, why use epilepsy patients for the study?
Good question. And that comes down to the fact that for developing technology, invasive technology, it's a challenge to move from animal testing into human testing. And so these epilepsy patients, they're already undergoing invasive brain monitoring. So this is a wonderful opportunity to evaluate these invasive brain electrodes in a patient population that's having them already for their clinical epilepsy treatment. So these patients are in the EMU, the epilepsy monitoring unit, usually for several days to a week or so, just waiting to have seizures, and we can tap in to these brain signals without much additional risk to the patient, and then evaluate these signals for this other application. And usually these patients are actually quite eager to basically play these mental video games because usually they're sitting around and not doing much else and kind of bored. So this is a wonderful opportunity to make use of these patient population who's getting this invasive technology anyway for this other purpose.
Yeah, it would seem that if epilepsy patients are just, for the most part, sitting around waiting to have unpredictable events,
right,
and they already have the invasive probes inside them, it would seem that it's a win-win because they would like to not be bored and
right,
they would like to get information about the brain. Are a fair number of epilepsy monitoring units that are doing this kind of work?
The number of BMI lab or brain machine interface research groups has just grown exponentially over the last decade. And in turn, the number of epilepsy monitoring units that are getting involved in this type of research has also grown. However, there isn't that many doing SEEG, specifically just because SEEGs are not that common yet. However, these BMI studies can be done in the epilepsy unit without really disrupting any of the ongoing clinical monitoring. It's quite simple to, at the point where the electrodes come out of the brain and connect into the junction box that carries the signals to the clinical recording system, if you just put like a little Y connector and split off a copy of the signal to the research system, you can run these things in parallel and do your BMI studies without disrupting the ongoing clinical monitoring. So this is actually becoming quite common in many epilepsy monitoring units.
I think this is a good point to talk a little bit about the study that's being published. So maybe at this point, either Dr. Taylor or Dr. Vadera, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the study and the patients and what they had to do and how you use their SEEG signals.
Well, this was actually a very preliminary study, and this was very simple 2D cursor control that we had them use their brain signals to control movements in two dimensions, and they had to get the cursor to targets on the screen that would appear. We used an abstract control paradigm that's actually fairly robust and fairly commonly used in EEG-based BMI studies, so we thought it would be a good starting point for this SEEG study since it's already been shown to be a very robust paradigm. And this robust paradigm is where people use changes in brain signals associated with moving or resting two different body parts to control the horizontal and vertical component of the cursor movement in real time. So these two participants both had an SEEG, one or two SEEG electrodes that penetrated through the hand knob area that went all the way through to the foot cortex. And so we specifically chose hand and foot movements as the two body parts that they would use to wiggle or rest to get the cursor to move horizontally and vertically. And participants were instructed to wiggle or relax their hand to varying degrees to control the horizontal component of the cursor velocity, and then they would wiggle or relax their foot to varying degrees to control the vertical component of the cursor velocity. And in this manner, they weren't actually controlling it with their hands and feet. They were controlling it with the brain signals, the changes in the brain signals associated with those movements. But that was the paradigm that they used to get the cursor to move toward the target just by wiggling or resting their hands and feet by different degrees. So this was a very abstract control strategy that has, made use of a well-established phenomenon of changes in power associated with moving or resting different body parts, and specifically the drop in power in the alpha and beta band and an increase in power in the gamma band during attempted movements.
Now, I assume that you've tried this already with patients who have subdural grids. Do you find that there are any specific advantages for using one technique over the other?
So we have done this with subdural grid patients as well, and we were able to get fairly good control there. Again, it really depends on where the electrodes are. And for these two particular patients, the fact that they had FEGs specifically that where a single lead would go through the hand knob area through to the foot cortex, our offline analysis showed that had we eliminated all the other electrodes that we also used in the study, but just focused on that, that we would actually have gotten most likely better control by just using a single SEEG lead through the hand and foot cortex. So the advantage would be that with the single burr hole, we would potentially be able to get both hand and foot cortex and allow them to do two-dimensional control just out of a single electrode penetrated through a single small burr hole. And to do that, to get hand and foot cortex through subdural grid would have been a much more complicated surgery.
Absolutely. And just wondering, the hand or the foot, was one of them more accurate than the other? Did subjects have an easier time learning using the hand or the foot, or is it not enough data from just two patients to know that?
We did not see any specific preference or strength in one versus the other. Both actually had fairly equivalent quality of movement control from that. And we could see that multiple contacts within the hand area as well as multiple contacts within the foot area were strongly modulated with the movement. So that meant the placement of it, as far as depth-wise, did not have to be exact because multiple spots along there were able to pick up the useful information.
So the advantages of SEEG for a brain-machine interface seem to parallel the advantages of SEEG for epilepsy monitoring. I'm wondering if you, Dr. Vedera, given the risks and the benefits of SEEG, do you see the use of SEEG growing in this country? I know that you say it's fairly commonly used still in Europe, but do you see it growing here in this country?
Yeah, I do think that it seems that there's now an increased interest in SEEG from like what I've heard from other places. I think that it's a great tool, and you know, so is subdural grids, and I think they both have very specific benefits that allow specific patients to be treated. I think it all depends on what the patient's clinical presentation is, whether SEEG or subdural grids are beneficial in those cases, but I think that it certainly will have some advantages in the future, and I'm hoping that there's growing interest in across the country.
Well, this is all quite exciting. I know the editors all found this to be quite a novel application, which is the basis for our discussion today. I do have some questions about the robustness and longevity and some thoughts you might have on this. So one of the problems that's plagued penetrating electrodes in other models has been the fact that after a while you get a loss of signal, probably related to changes in tissue around the electrode, maybe some scar formation and so on. So I'm wondering if you have anything to say or any comments to make about the longest that you've had SEEG electrodes in place and whether there's been any reduction in the signal integrity over time. So maybe you can comment on that issue.
In speaking with Dr. Gonzalez-Martinez, on average, patients usually have SEEGs implanted for about 7 days. The range is pretty broad, from 3 days to, you know, up to 28 days. I think that in that time, it has not been such a concern in terms of losing signal due to gliosis, but more so I think that they've noticed that over time there is a little bit of EEG pullout, or SEEG pullout, and so there's some small amount of migration over time. But I think that's been more of a concern than gliosis forming around the electrodes in that shorter period of time.
Also, I think you're probably referring to the problems that have been seen on intercortical microelectrodes that are these hair-thin, tiny little prongs that go a few millimeters into the cortex. And those type of electrodes do have very specifically the type of problem that you're talking about, where gliosis encapsulation around those electrodes does cause a loss of the signal. But those types of electrodes, which are a fundamental mainstay of brain-machine interfacing, they're picking up a very different type of signal, and the gliosis is a lot more of a problem with that kind of signal. Those penetrating microelectrodes are designed to detect the action potentials of individual cells. So when there's a little bit of encapsulation, that pushes the cell body away from these very tiny recording contacts. And therefore, the little blips of the action potentials are farther away, and the voltage for each blip is not as strong, so it kind of blends into the background noise. Whereas with SEEGs, yes, they're also implanted, so you're likely to get a similar response with encapsulation. However, they're not trying to detect action potentials from individual cells. They're trying, just like subdural grids, they're really detecting oscillations in the aggregate voltage that's due to, you know, the entire network activity of current flow through the dendrites and cell bodies and throughout the entire network. And so we're not trying to pick up individual action potentials with these types of electrodes. It's more the global network activity. Right. And it's really unknown yet how much that kind of gliosis on these types of electrodes will impact our ability to detect the types of signal changes that we're interested in for brain-machine interface or for epilepsy. And with brain-machine interface, if we're developing technology for paralyzed individuals, these things need to last the lifetime of the individual. So that is actually something we are actively looking at in our animal studies, is to track how the gliosis around the electrodes impacts the long-term recording of these more field potential global oscillations that are happening in the network.
Well, it's an issue of interest to the DBS community as well, especially, as you mentioned, the closed-loop feedback types of DBS electrodes that are now being developed. But I guess if it's any consolation, the DBS that people have used now for decades seems to be pretty sturdy and pretty robust over many years, and it hasn't lost efficacy, at least not due to gliosis in general. So it's
right.
Hopeful that if you're not trying to catch single cells, that the group activity is actually going to be pretty robust.
Right, and with the DBS electrodes, you're pumping current out there,
right,
which
right.
can, you know,
so that's
clean
that,
off
yeah,
some of that.
Yeah, it gives it an additional
gliosis.
Excuse to,
right.
to lose the fidelity. But I think in a recording kind of way,
right.
It probably is even better off.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing you mentioned in your paper was the fact that you tried both open-loop and closed-loop feedback for your subjects, but you found that the closed-loop feedback wasn't particularly helpful in improving people's performance and accuracy of cursor movement. And I was wondering if you could give us some thoughts about why that was the case in these two patients.
Generally, closed loop, meaning the person seeing their cursor move in real time and they can then modulate their brain signals to get the cursor where they need to go. Generally, closed loop, you have the visual feedback. You can steer the cursor if it's starting to go off track. So in general, that's thought to be better. And the feedback probably did help the patients in this case during the closed loop trials. But because this was our very first preliminary testing, we wanted to throw in signals from multiple brain areas into our decoding function that translated the brain signals into cursor movement. And so there was a lot of brain areas that we had included in there that probably were just adding unnecessary noise, and we didn't know if they would, you know, become useful, if this person would figure out how to use parietal cortex or use, you know, some other cortical area to modulate and steer the cursor. But in reality, what it appeared to do was just add excess noise, which then made it very difficult for the person to steer using, you know, this abstract control strategy of wiggling their feet or wiggling their hands. And again, these were, one patient just had one testing session and another patient just had two, so there really wasn't time for the long-term learning that you would expect with a BMI system. However, when we did the offline decoding where we reanalyzed the signals that we recorded, that's where we saw that had we only used the single SEEG electrode that had gone through the motor cortex or the single one that had gone through the sensory cortex, we would have been much better off. And that's why our offline open-loop data actually looked better, because it had eliminated the inputs from all these other brain areas that were just adding excess noise to the decoding.
So I assume that the center there is continuing to put in SEEG electrodes into epilepsy patients. And I'm wondering, what's your next step here with this project? Are you guys going to continue to do this and just utilize that single contact in the motor cortex as your input?
The choice of where the electrodes go is completely based on their epilepsy requirements for optimizing their identification of the epileptic focus. So we don't have a say as to where they put the electrodes for the BMI studies. However, we would certainly focus our patients, our subjects, study subject selection on patients that have electrodes in the most likely areas that we would implant specifically for the applications we're looking at here, which is a motor restoration kind of application. What we would like to branch into in the future is optimizing the decoding more for some less abstract and more natural control. In fact, with those patients, we actually had them make not just hand wiggles and foot wiggles, but we actually tracked their arm movements using a Wiimote system, like the Wii video game. So we had them doing actual arm movements as we recorded the neural signals, and now we're going back in to look at those signals to see if we can optimize our decoding in order to predict more natural arm movements so that we could then use those types of signals for control instead of this abstract hands and foot wiggle type control.
Well, this is all extremely exciting development in a brain-machine interface. Well, I think we can end our discussion here. I would like to thank both Drs. Taylor and Vadera for joining us today, and I'd like to thank them for contributing this interesting piece of work to this issue of neurosurgical focus and for taking the time to join me in this stimulating discussion of the brain-machine interface and SEEG. It's been very informative, and I look forward to the continued leadership of this prolific group in this exciting new field. Thank you both for joining us.
Well, thank you
very much.
This concludes our podcast for the June issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the July issue, when the topic will be cervical spondylotic myelopathy. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter, and now also on Facebook.